and a resident of Luskidee, as well as project leader and professor of resource and environmental management, Sean Markey. CJSF attended the event and spoke with Lepofsky and Markey about the ways in which they believe this project has been able to honor, respect, and protect Indigenous heritage in Luskidee. One of the main ways that they've been able to achieve this has been through public outreach and education. Until recently, it was widely believed by the residents of Luskidee that there was no Indigenous heritage or presence on the island. According to Lepofsky and Markey, this research project has undoubtedly dispelled this myth.
And I should say that I'm a resident here. I was a part-time resident for many decades and now a full-time resident. So I have been kind of slowly working away at talking to people about Indigenous history and to break down that myth of First Nations were never here permanently. Okay, they came here to collect resources, but they certainly didn't live here full time. There weren't very big numbers. You know, there was a lot of that same kind of truths going around, but slowly, surely over the decades of working with community members and going to fall fairs and commute and to the market and giving talks, many people started to realize that, oh yeah, really, this doesn't make sense. And we're so happy to embrace it. But even with that, it was just kind of slow baby steps forward. And I was surprised that when we launched our project we got the funding, well, you know, in the same month that everything shut down around COVID, I was surprised that even given me doing this for decades and living here and being known to people and having pretty widespread group of friends, that people still didn't know. So it took this kind of massive amount of effort on the project team's part to actually, now no one can say they haven't heard it. Some people still don't believe it, but everybody has heard it and most people embrace it.
Afterwards, Sean Markey expanded on the planning and policy aspect of the research project.
You know, this is where the planning and the policy piece comes in, is that those two systems have also done nothing really to educate people, to make information available to people. There's nothing, for example, you know, there should be, and there's sort of, as I articulated in the talk, there is good policy in place about, you know, it's illegal to disrupt Indigenous heritage and those types of things. But in terms of its presence and ready access to information about where sites are, incorporating knowledge about sites and what it means to have a site on property within the real estate process, for example, is all pretty much completely absent and very much, again, just simply reflective of those colonial myths and colonial systems that are in place to really not value it. And as I mentioned in the talk, it has really sort of more seen Indigenous heritage as a barrier to facilitating the development and something of value in its own right.
Later on in the discussion, Lepofsky emphasized the importance of Indigenous communities and knowledge holders playing a leading role in archaeological research such as this.
And it shouldn't happen. This is the thing, is that archaeology is this extraordinarily privileged position, as is planners who get to make or enact different policies around Indigenous heritage. We're the outsiders. It's not our heritage. So it's kind of it's a funny position in a way. So it's a privilege to be able to talk about planning and archaeology of someone else's heritage. And so it can't happen. It shouldn't happen. It would be silly for it to happen without, a partnered endeavor.
Since this research project focuses primarily on Luskidee or Hoyatai, we decided to ask Dana Lepofsky if she could explain how similar research could be utilized to advance Indigenous reconciliation in somewhere such as Burnaby.
I believe really strongly in the power of archaeology, and it's been an archaeological part of the archaeological culture with some good reasons to actually keep, like, where archaeological sites are private, because a couple bad actors will always come in and do some damage and trespass and dig up things. And so it's meant that the public doesn't really know or see archaeology. But I think they want to. So over all the years, every time I've done an excavation, one of the criteria that I have when I'm working with community members is we can go anywhere in your territory you want, but I also want to do something that's very public, that's very accessible. And I sometimes even design my excavation units so that, I've done this quite a few times, so that people can gather around them so it's safe, like easy access and easy viewing, because I believe in the power of archaeology to change. And it's not just for settlers, it's for Indigenous youth as well. When you see this colonial landscape with manicured lawns and gardens and stuff, it's hard to know unless someone helps you see that right below their feet is like, you know, thousands of years of their own history. So I talk about kind of teaching people to have archaeology eyes. So in Burnaby, easy. Like, you know, we could pick a place. And every time we've done this, like I always say to my husband, oh, no one's going to come, you know, no press are going to come. But anyway, after all these years, I think I'd know, but so wrong. People come in droves. They want to know. People love archaeology. They're drawn to it, even if they don't necessarily yet jive with the you know, the kind of the truth around Indigenous history. They still love the archaeology. There's a cool factor. Actually, we have a student who's doing interviews about that. Like, what is it about that we're drawn to around the material objects and the like? So I would say what we're doing here has parallels in so many places, and many places are doing this. It helps here because it's an island, so it's easy. It's contained. We know our audience, but in the Fraser Valley, where I've worked, and other places, it's the same story. People will come. You just need to make it open and available and inviting, and you need to keep at it, and you need to make sure that to really make systemic change, you need to work with the policy folks. You need to, in Burnaby, like you need to work with the municipality in Burnaby, do the exact same thing, have public archaeology, have people come, have people participate, work with the teachers. It's all the same playbook, really.
Lastly, Sean Markey expanded on this sentiment and explained how local governments could be doing more to collaborate with local Indigenous communities.
I would add, yeah, I mean, I mentioned the talk just as a planner. I'm somewhat familiar with what archaeology is, but I had no real true appreciation for how powerful it can be to mediate conversations in the present. In addition to that engaged archaeological approach that Dana was just talking about, you know, I witnessed, you know, really powerfully firsthand within the XLAP project, the power of building relationships, of just gathering together with settlers, with nations. Some of the fear drops away, right? The fear of doing the wrong thing, for example, which I know can inhibit a lot of local governments from just simply reaching out. They're worried about offending or doing the wrong thing, or they don't know how. A common response that I hear from nations is, well, you could phone and ask, right? So, you know, I think, you know, creating pathways where settlers can interact with nations and learn about their history is incredibly powerful.
Once again, you were listening to Dana Lepofsky and Sean Markey, two leading researchers, a part of the Huayatai Leskidi archaeology project that is working towards using their archaeological findings to educate the island's residents on its Indigenous history, as well as foster and advance Indigenous reconciliation on Leskidi. Once again, this has been Danny Nesvedarani, your community journalist for CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby. This segment would not be possible without the continued support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative. You can also find this piece on frequencynews.ca. And once again, we are back with Speak Up, only on CJSF 90.1 FM. That was my piece on archaeology work that is being done by researchers at SFU on Leskidi or Huayatai. And coming up next and coming up last, we have one more segment. This is more of a long-form interview, and this also comes from our other local journalist and programming coordinator here at CJSF, Jesse. And this is an interview that he did with the director and writer of a documentary that came out this year titled The Stand, which details an instance in 1985 on Lyell Island where the Haida people of that land demanded recognition of Aboriginal title to allow them to protect the land from destructive logging and resource extraction that was occurring at the time. So this is about a 17-minute piece, and this will end off today's episode of Speak Up. I want to thank you all so much for tuning in, and make sure you stay tuned because we have, well, this piece coming up, but right after at 11 a.m. we also have Democracy Now!
In the fall of 1985, the Haida people began their blockade of a road on Lyell Island, demanding the recognition of Aboriginal title to allow them to protect their land from destructive logging and resource extraction. Chris Auchter's feature documentary, The Stand, tells the story, now largely forgotten, of the Haida resistance and their long, complex battle to protect their ancestral land and way of life. Drawn from stunning archival footage and audio, The Stand provides unprecedented behind-the-scenes access into the planning, organization, and execution of the Haida blockade, their engagement with media and political figures as they work to sway public opinion, and insights into the actions and attitudes of police, logging workers, and executives. I'm Jesse Wentzloff from CJSF, and I'm now meeting with writer and director of The Stand, Chris Auchter. Welcome, Chris.
Hi, Jesse. My name's Christopher Auchter. I'm a filmmaker, Haida filmmaker. My Haida name is Watsas Day, from the Yaqalanis clan from Dawdins on Haida Gwaii. Like I said, I'm a filmmaker. I make films. I love to tell stories, both in animation, documentary, and beyond, I guess.
Thank you. And you're here because your documentary film, The Stand, is returning to the VIF Center Friday, February 28th. And this documentary tells the story of Haida resistance to logging on their traditional territories and the long, drawn-out process of that resistance and moving towards some sort of resolution. What drew you to this story?
Yeah, what drew me was my aunt and my uncle. They lived it. They were down there in Lyell Island fighting with the Haida. And yeah, I grew up and I knew they were down there. I was only 5 years old when it was happening, so I didn't remember anything that so I didn't know what happened down there, I guess what I'm trying to say. So that was the beginning of it, was me wanting to honor my aunt and my uncle in some way, Michael Nicol Yaqalanis and Shelley Hegeman, and thinking this was a really important moment in our history and I should know it, and it would be great to know it. So that's where it started, and it was such a big pool to swim in because there was so much footage, which was great. Yeah, I had amassed like over 100 hours worth of video and audio. Some things, like I was also looking for what was happening before this all happened so I could have some understanding. So I was listening to interviews and different people talking from times before. And yeah, it was fascinating. It took up, yeah, it was 4 years to kind of get to this point, but I had a great team with me, really talented. And I think we brought together something, I think, special. And I think it's a unique experience, and it's not a film that I could just turn around and okay, I'm going to do another one just like that, because it was just like, it was just such a unique opportunity to have this footage. A large amount of it was gathered from Susan Underwood and Donna Wilson. There were two filmmakers that lived here in the Lower Mainland, like around Vancouver, and they heard this was happening. The Haida were putting boots on the ground and on these logging roads, and they were like, this sounds important. We should get up there and see if we can film it. And the Haida let them in. They let them stay with them at the Haida camp. And I was told, because they were already thinking about the future, they were saying, we want people in the future to be able to see what it took and what we did down here, which I thought was so amazing, because, you know, that generation or so later, myself, that's what I was doing. And I needed this, like, mm-hmm. to be able to understand.
There's so many things there just to pull apart. One, the footage itself is really, really riveting and astounding to see, like you're saying, the level of access that was provided and how embedded the videographers were. You capture some really intimate moments, some moments of strategizing ahead of going out to the protests, all these things that, yeah, it would be hard to imagine how you would tell the story without some of that.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. And to grab those nuances was just so important as well. And to be able to, because then the audience could start seeing inside and understanding the people that were there and kind of feeling for them, like we do as when we watch a film, we start feeling for the characters that mm-hmm. are on the film. So it gave us a chance to understand them and to relate. And also it was so important for me to not insert myself in there. I kind of did with Mouse Woman a bit because I was thinking that the supernatural beings were there helping the Haida. And the supernatural beings are such a big part of our culture. And I think what the Haida were fighting for the survival of our culture. And it was important for me to let them tell their stories, the ones that were there and were captured on film, for them to explain why they're doing it now, why they're there, what it's all about. It came from the best possible sources. It came from the source. And they were just so well-spoken as well, so articulate.
Yeah, one of the things that stood out to me from some of that behind-the-scenes planning footage is how aware of strategy and how aware of the process that they were going through. I'm not sure who says it, but at one point they say, we're in the theater business now. Yeah. And as you said, they knew that it was worth letting these videographers in to preserve it for the future. I was really impressed by the level of awareness of how to do what they were doing. Do you know where that comes from?
Totally. No, you're making great points there. And that's one of my favorite lines of the whole film mm-hmm. is, you know, we're in the theater business now. That came from Gujao, or Gary Edenshaw, who had become, he became the president of the Haida Nation after Miles Richardson, who's in the film. So then it was Gujao, who was for many years. It was really well thought out in terms of we need the media to be here to spread the word so that it's covered on the news, so that we could start getting other people behind us. And it's not just the Haida, then they're expanding the group that's behind them to go, hey, hey, and being able to talk to the politicians and put pressure on them to talk to the Haida even. That's really what the Haida were just, they wanted that to have a partner to talk to and go, we got to figure this out. So they knew that was important. And my uncle Mike, when I talked to him, he said, they could see when it was shifting, when people around BC or Canada were starting to get like kind of complacent about, oh, we've heard it, we saw it, and they start to on other issues. They would let there be a little bit of time, and then they would do something else that kind of caught people's eye and go, oh yeah, the Haida and what's going on down there. And even Jack Webster, like, he's amazing in the film in that it's so electric the way he just engages. And he's got this thunderous voice that just goes after people. And if they're going to survive, they got to go back after him in order to have their voices heard. But I think it's exciting to watch.
Yeah. Well, and it pulls something out, right? Like it pulls the responses exactly. out. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I was just going to say, like, I'm grateful that he covered it, and he covered it so expansively, even though, you know, he had his own stakes in terms of why he was doing it. But it was amazing, and I'm grateful that he covered it, yeah, as I said.
Yeah, and that, I think that also it's emblematic of throughout this action, I guess, the political action, the protest, this recognition that the Haida were going to have to engage with the legal system. We're going to have to engage on the Canadian government or the British Columbian government's terms, even though to that point, any engagement on those governments' parts had seemingly been in bad faith or had not really worked out in the way that the Haida had hoped. And so there's this recognition and resiliency to be like, well, this is the way it has to be done, even though it has not worked so far.
Well, yeah, because there were talks before this, before they stood on the road, on the logging road. They thought they had a handshake agreement that the government wasn't going to extend the tree farm license in that area of Lyle Island and stuff because it had expired. And they said, no, yeah, we're not going to green light and renew it. And then they flew home from Skidigit. And not much time had passed, and they renewed the license. And that, with the landslides, the Haida were like, okay, we got to get down there. It's getting crazy, and they're not listening. So they had to go, and almost because the governments weren't willing to talk and just hash it out, the legal system had to get involved, and the courts and stuff like that. And the courts were saying, like, this isn't a court matter, like solve it politically. But then the government would appeal that decision and go back through the courts. So it just became locked in the courts. I'll just say this because I remember just earlier what we were talking about. Also, another great inspiration for the Haida, I asked my uncle, and he said it was Gandhi himself as well in terms of the root of nonviolence. So I thought that was pretty interesting as well.
Yeah, to be sort of sourcing global inspiration for this very, very local resistance.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I guess I want to talk a little bit about the film itself. You said earlier that you were aware of this, you have family connections. In going through all the footage, did you learn anything? Like, were you surprised by the story that unfolded?
Yeah, I mean, I learned so much. And I mean, I was so intrigued with like we were talking about earlier, kind of those behind the scenes moments where they were practicing for what they think was going to be happening on the road. And they had Sven Robinson, who was an NDP MLA elected, there with them. Yeah. And who's also a lawyer. So he was able to say, this is, you know, how it's going to work and stuff like that. And kind of, you know, let them know so that the Haida could practice it and kind of, you know, this is where we're going to stand. This is what we're going to do. But it's just the way that they were talking. It just felt so rare to be able to peek into those moments and go, oh, that was what it's like. And that's what's going through their minds. And yeah. So, I mean, like the whole thing I learned pretty much, right? Like the whole thing was a learning classroom for me because I just started out with the point that I knew my aunt and uncle were there. And then I don't know. I didn't even really know what the area looked like. Right. Like, and, what the Haida camp looked like and Frank Bevin's camp and stuff like that. So all these things were new for me because then when things interest me and kind of piqued me when I was first learning about it, they're those homing devices where you go, okay, let's red bold this. I think other people are going to be really interested and fascinated about this as well. But I mean, it was so fascinating. I remember trying to piece together because I was asking the questions too, like, why are the Haida doing this now? And like, why not earlier? Why now? What do the Haida want? What do we want? So it was so fascinating when we're sitting around the fire and listening to an elder, Ethel Jones, speak. And she says this, and it's in the film, you know, like, well, you know, we're here. We're not sure what's going on, but we're here. And then the way they talk too, and saying, you know, like, I think that's why we're here. It's about land claims and, you know, I think that's the whole point and stuff like that. Like just the way that they're talking, it was just so reassuring too, to know that they're putting this all together too. And it's not a boom, we know everything all at once. And here it is, like to know that it's organic and it's growing at the same time. That was really fascinating to me as well. And like I said, like with that going back to the rehearsal night, it was just so interesting to hear why they did the rattles the way they did and to have it explained by Gu Zhao, you know, why they had the paint and stuff like that, why they were wearing the paint. Like those things are fascinating to me. And they're expressed in such a human way in that it's not perfect and it's not super, like even though Gu Zhao, like he's a great speaker and stuff like this, but I wanted to show that he was searching inside of himself for that answer as well. And it wasn't just a ready, here's the script and the perfect words, like, you know, like,
right.
Yeah. I think that's fascinating.
Yeah, well, and that even though, you know, as we were talking about earlier, there did seem to be strategy and planning and an awareness of what to do, they didn't necessarily, you know, consciously know all those things before starting, right? Like that those were sort of revealed to them through the process in a way.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. And we could do that in so many different ways. It's the same way with making a film. You don't know the whole thing going in. You're kind of slowly coming to you as well. So yeah.
With the benefit of hindsight, I think you can look at this instance of resistance as maybe not a template, but as an example for future instances of Indigenous resistance and land defense, thinking about the Kanastake resistance or the Wet'suwet'en. Does that resonate with you? Do you think that this inspired others?
I think it did. I spoke with my uncle Mike, and he said this sort of thing wasn't really done before in like the RCMP, the loggers, the government, the courts didn't know how to deal with this because they hadn't seen it before. It was all new and there was no playbook on how to handle this situation. And I think it couldn't have been handled in terms of the RCMP's case in a better way. Like Inspector Harry Wallace and his team, like they were just had such a, they had just had so much respect and the lines of communication were open. And I think, you know, the HIDTA were giving respect and they were getting it back as well. And even from the loggers as well. So I definitely think that we can all learn from this, which is why, you know, going back to that hidden story, like, I don't think, even though this, I think this footage has been shown a little bit in quite a few different shorts. And there was also another documentary made in the year 2000 that had Susan Underwood as a part of the creation crew in this, but it was Ravens and Eagles. I think it was Atlee Gwei. But I don't think, like, in terms of, like, this film is in terms of showing, like, it's almost like we're witnessing and we're standing on the road with them and we could see it unfolding before our eyes. And yeah, I don't think a lot of people have seen this before, and especially in this way. And I think it can be RCMP, people who are trying to stand up for a cause that they strongly believe needs to have change and can look at this and go, oh, that's really fascinating. We can learn a lot from this. And because that's what we say about history all the time, right? Is please, let's learn from it. So we're not stumbling over the same stone time and time again. So, yeah.
For audiences who are interested to come see the film, what do you hope they take away from watching The Stand?
Well, I think definitely there's lots that we could pull in terms of that learning. I think there's a lot that we could take from seeing another culture and being able to relate to them and going, oh, they're like us. And, mm-hmm. or, you know, I think there's that love and respect that comes. And I think that the film, I think, encapsulates the message in the song at the end that plays during the credits. So if you come and watch the film, like, I hope you'll, yeah, and enjoy that song. I think it's a powerful song, and I call it Ada's message. And yeah, she was an elder that was there, but I think that's what I'd like people to pull from it.
Great. Well, thanks for taking the time to sit down with me, Chris.
Yeah, thank you, Jesse. I really enjoyed this.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the film. So I heartily endorse going out to see it starting this. Oh, yeah, no, go ahead.
Yeah, oh, sorry. Yeah, you saying starting, and it goes all the way till March 20th. We have screenings all the way. So there's like, I think it shows 8 different times at the VIF Center. So
yeah, lots of chances to get out and see it. So that's great.
Yeah, thank you.
Cool. Thanks, Chris.
Produced and distributed by the National Film Board of Canada, The Stand opens at the VIF Center in Vancouver on Friday, February 28th, and plays until Thursday, March 21st. It will be released online for free streaming across Canada on nfb.ca, starting June 19th, 2025. This piece would not be possible without funding from the Community Radio Fund of Canada's Local Journalism Initiative, and is available online with stories from across the country at frequencynews.ca.
Thank you so much to Jesse for that piece. And if you haven't seen The Stand, you should definitely go do so. It's a really, really fascinating documentary, and one that I think is really pertinent and just sort of exemplifies the kind of colonial institutional mindset that puts profit and resource extraction over the very real concerns and rights to land of Indigenous peoples throughout all of Canada, really. So, again, thank you all so much for tuning in this hour, this week for Tuesday Speak Up. Jesse will be back on Thursday this week for another episode of Speak Up, so make sure you stay tuned for that. And coming up right in about a minute, we have Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman, so make sure you stay tuned for that as well. And lastly, I hope you have a great day.
Embark Sustainability Society is an independent, student-centered nonprofit working across SFU campuses. Embark focuses on climate and food justice in their programs and initiatives. Some of their ongoing work includes their food rescue program, learning gardens, and sustainability career nights. Discover your role in building a sustainable future based on your unique skills and interests. Learn more at embarksustainability.org and follow along on Instagram at embarksustain.